Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern, and I am joined by my old friends Heidi White, Tim McIntosh. Heidi, Tim, how's it going? Tim's on the phone. He's on the phone line instead of the Zoom line. Heidi's on,
I'm on the phone.
Zoom
That's
line.
That's right.
Everybody, can you hear me? You guys, can you hear me?
Can you talk louder? Just a little louder.
What?
That's good, right there. I'm gonna need you at that volume the whole episode.
The whole time.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, great.
That's okay. What you get for being on the phone.
Yeah. You definitely chose to go this route.
This is why Tim can't have nice things. Yeah.
That's right. You have one job, have Wi-Fi.
It's all...
Hey, did you guys miss me last week?
Exactly. I had to mix things up and change the time of day that we're recording, and now Tim's internet doesn't work. Sorry for screwing things up.
That's right.
Well, Tim, we're glad to have you back. You were lost at sea. But although now that I think about it, that does explain why you don't have internet. Being lost at sea, the Wi-Fi is probably not great out there.
Exactly. I'm actually home. I'm home.
What's that
got
to do with
it?
Not in a dank basement of any kind. No, I'm fresh from catching a steelhead on the Solduck River on the Olympic Peninsula. What?
That
you guys
sounds
want to talk
amazing.
More about that?
That was Thursday.
I mean, it really was amazing.
I read A River Runs Through It. I know all there is to know about the fishing life.
Yeah.
It was great.
Did you camp and fish? Did you cabin and fish? Did you sleep in a van by the river?
Hotel and fish.
Okay.
Hotel and fish.
Okay.
We got up like 4 o'clock on Tuesday morning and we were on the river by 4:45.
All right. Nice.
It's great. Yeah.
Nice. All right. Well, we have a more limited amount of time than usual this week. So we're going to dive right in. That's enough small talk out of you. We are here to discuss the final pages, really the final section of Graham Greene's The End of the Affair. Next week, we will answer your listener questions. And so that will give us a chance to fill in any gaps as usual. Don't forget, you can send questions to us via Facebook. That's typing Close Reads on the search bar. If you've not joined the Facebook group already, if you want to post a question, you're already on there. Just find the post. It'll be pinned as an announcement at the top of the page and you can put your comment there in the thread. You can also email us at closereadspodcast@gmail.com and we're on Instagram at closereadspods. The newsletter is closereads.substack.com. And then our Patreon page is patreon.com/closereads. We are working our way through Crime and Punishment, of course. And then also this Friday, we are going to be recording what we're calling a mailbag episode. So we've been inviting people to send us questions on Facebook or via email, and we will answer all kinds of questions, just a wide ranging fun episode, just kind of, a bit of nonsense, I suppose, is one way of putting it. So if you're on supporting the show on Patreon, you're going to have access to that. If you're not supporting the show on Patreon, then you're missing out on some great content as well as some sweet show swag. I'm thinking about practicing a Sean Connery accent, using that phrase just over and over again. Sean Connery from the Indiana Jones movies, say. But I'm going to need Tim as my dialect coach. So Tim, put a pin in that for later.
Just remember, every word that starts with an S starts with an S-C-H.
Got it. Okay. Like Schwimmer, like David Schwimmer, the actor.
Well done.
Got it. Okay.
Well,
I'm gonna remember
done.
That. I'm going to remember that for the rest of the show.
You gotta pivot.
Yeah.
Now, see how powerful it is?
No, but I'm going to learn. Okay. So we are here to discuss the end of the affair. And I want to dive right in here just because we have limited time, as I said. And I've got a question for you guys because I was thinking about the way this novel has been received over the years. And I know that Greene was a little bit, he wasn't terribly happy with the way it ended. But there's been a lot of writing about this book. It shows up on a lot of lists and has had lots of great criticism. William Faulkner called it one of the most true and moving novels of my time in anybody's language, famously. That's on the back of some of the editions. But for The Independent, which is the newspaper magazine in the UK, A writer, a novelist by the name of Alex Preston wrote something that I wanted to get your feedback on. And he says, of course, right as I go to it here, it makes me answer some of the questions, like one of those quizzes that pops up on a page.
Oh, no.
So, okay.
Oh, no.
All right. Do I think there's more nostalgia in filmmaking now? Yes, absolutely. Maybe a little. No, not at all. Oh, it went away now. Okay, good. I didn't even have to answer the question. All right. Riveting radio here. Riveting podcasting. Okay. Alex Preston, in his retrospective on this book, he writes this. He quotes the final passage, right? Where Bendrix writes, "Oh God, you've done enough. You've robbed me of enough. I'm too tired and old to learn to love. Leave me alone forever." So he writes that, and then he says, this is Alex Preston writing, "Bendrix shows that there is no comfort in his newfound relationship with God." I found this a really thought-provoking assertion. So I would like to talk about that as a way on entryway into this section of the book and these last pages. Do you think that that is what Bendrix shows? Do you think that that is what this novel shows, that there is no comfort in Bendrix's newfound relationship with God? Patty, what do you think about this?
Well, it's deliberately ambiguous. So you're going to, as readers, I think our interpretation of the end says more about us than it says about the actual end of the novel. And that's what an ambiguous ending does, right? It awakens within us our latent assumptions. So if there is a latent assumption that there is no comfort in a newfound relationship with God, then that's what you're going to see. So I think it says something there. I, as someone for whom a relationship with God is infinitely comforting, I see him as on a pathway to redemption, which circles back to the beginning of the novel that claims, you know, you just arbitrarily pick a beginning and an ending. And I think he's on a road to being redeemed, but it's not quite embraced the love of God yet. But that says a lot about my latent assumptions, which is true.
Tim, what about you?
I must have the same latent assumptions. I actually thought that the ending was a little bit less ambiguous, maybe Heidi, than you think. I saw it as he's repeating the same sorts of things that Sarah was saying in the beginning of her journal entries. Mm-hmm. But she was taking no comfort in God's existence. She kind of wanted out. She was searching for any way out. And then gradually through her diary entries and through the subsequent things that we discover about Sarah, we find out, no, she was actually on this path and God's presence in her life became this source of peace. I mean, maybe it wasn't fully realized because of her premature death, but the reviewer seems to imply that Bendrix has arrived because he now believes in God, that he's like arrived at a place where his understanding of God is completed, that it's come full circle. And it's, to me, it's like, no, he's just starting. This is just the beginning. This is not the final resting place for Bendrix. Or, I mean, maybe he'll veer off the path. Sarah didn't, and maybe he will on down the line. But I get the impression that we are, that the conclusion of the book is echoing what we heard from Sarah in the middle and late part of this novel. Maybe I'm just too rigid of a reader that I saw, I don't know. I saw it as a little bit less ambiguous. I fully grant that it's
then,
not.
Than Heidi. Than what Heidi is. Is that what you're saying?
Than Heidi, yeah. I completely agree that it's not it's not the sort of conclusion that you can like chart on a piece of graph paper. It's not crystal clear. But boy, it just seemed to me like Graham Greene really connected the dots in the final pages of the book.
David, how did you read it?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Are you a close reader or are you not a close reader? This is literally
what is
your
going
podcast.
On with you, dude?
No,
I don't know.
I didn't. The question. So, okay, I got to trace what just happened, though. So, I asked the question, do you agree that there is no comfort in Bendrix's newfound relationship with God? Do you believe that, do you agree that is what the book is suggesting? How do you, your response was that the book is more ambiguous than that?
Yeah. And that we are going to read our own assumptions into the ending. We are going, if we will approach that, the final phrase of the book is leave me alone. So, are we going to, we are going to put our own assumptions onto that ending. That's my statement.
Yeah, but is the book itself suggest, does the book reveal within itself that Bendrix seems to think that it's a, that there's not comfort in it, that, that his, that the faith he has been drawn into almost for, that has almost been forced upon him is without comfort?
Well, and Tim says, no, or wait, is with comfort, that there is a, is that right, Tim? That there is a sense of comfort, like of solid. Comfort. In, okay. Prospect of comfort. David?
Because I think that Sarah experienced comfort eventually. And I think that we're seeing like that's the path that Bendrix is on. David?
I still don't understand how you answered the question, Heidi. I feel like you didn't answer it just as much as I did.
Now we're playing chicken on who's going to not answer the question. I think
that
there absolutely is a, well, see, comfort is the word I'm stumbling over because I'm not convinced that Sarah yet experiences comfort in the story. Mm-hmm. Other than the potential for beyond the grave with her miracles and her kind of drawing of those that she loved to the kingdom. But I don't think before she died, she had any comfort. So, but here's what I do believe is that comfort is not necessary for salvation.
Yeah.
And it is for people who walk, wisdom leads to comfort, and nobody in this book is wise. So I think that she is saved, and I think that Bendrix is on the same path. I completely agree with everything that you said, Tim, about the clues within the novel that tell us that he is on the path of salvation the same way that Sarah is, and that it's just a matter of time. That I completely agree with. Comfort is the word I'm stumbling over a bit.
But that's helpful because I think that there's more... I think that Sarah, there's like glimmers of peace before her death in the book. And that's part of the reason why I hold out the same hope for Bendrix. But I might be wrong about that. I've just kind of, I'll say it is definitely, if the prospect of peace for Sarah is in the book, it's not spoken with a megaphone. I think it's relatively muted. It's painted in watercolor. If you ask me for a passage, I'd have to spend time finding it. You know, I think there's like some, you know, bolded paragraph that shows that. But I've kind of either found that in the text or read that into the text and subsequently applied it to Bendrix. And if there's a weakness in my argument, that's probably what it is. Like maybe I presume too much peace for Sarah before her death.
It's interesting the equating of the terms comfort and peace. That has sort of emerged.
Yeah. But you did distinguish earlier in your comment that there's a difference between those two. And I think you're right. So anyway, now I really want to hear David's answer to the question.
David?
I don't think that necessarily he finds comfort. And I think... there's another line in the review that I wanted to ask you about because I think it has a lot to do with this idea. And that is, it's the Alex, the writer, I closed out of that Alex, whatever I said his name was. he said that Bendrix sort of caves under the weight of the evidence. And This is a book that's very evidence is a big concept throughout the whole thing. Of course, Smythe and Sarah are talking about it constantly. Smythe's talking about it with Bendrix. You've got the idea of a private eye who's going around trying to gather evidence. They're all trying to prove various things and and hide various things. And so if you think about it that way, if you think about it, the idea that his faith is sort of thrust upon him, but, you know, either because all the evidence begins to suggest to him that God exists, then his faith is not one of that would naturally be one of comfort, because his entire inclination, his sort of whole positioning, is so aggressively against God and against what Sarah came to believe in. You know, he has positioned himself emotionally and spiritually so aggressively against it that to eventually succumb to it would be the ultimate discomfort, right? Like, you know, and I you mentioned the idea of circularity. I think you both have said it. I think that the suggestion of Bendrix's future is in the theme of circularity within the book. I think that's why the book begins with this sort of suggestion that, you know, the suggestion of media res, right? In media res, there's, you know, where you begin is kind of arbitrary. I think that what's happening is that there's this circular thing going on, and he's at that point in his life in the circularity. And so what she eventually began to feel, I think, is meant to suggest how his heart and soul begin to evolve too. So that's my answer to the question. What do you guys think about the evidence thing?
So can you read the line from the reviewer about evidence?
Yeah, just a second. Okay. No, I don't want to register for free today.
Wow, they're bombarding you.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, The Guardian will get you on stuff.
Well, this is The Independent, one of those classic English names. Of course, the name of the newspaper is just The Independent. That's it. Okay. He says, I'm going to read the whole paragraph. The novel inserted fissures of doubt in my adolescent atheism. This is the writer speaking. I remember going to the American church on finishing the book and sitting at the end of the back of the room waiting for some sort of epiphany. The End of the Affair provides a blueprint for finding a way into belief. Bendrick's sardonic, burly resistance to Sarah's God finally breaks when the weight of evidence becomes too much. But this is not a happy conversion. And then the line that I mentioned, there is no comfort in this newfound relationship with God. So Bendrick's sardonic, burly resistance to Sarah's God finally breaks when the weight of evidence becomes too much. Do you think that's is that how you read this book?
No, not even a tiny little bit. 0% how I read that.
Before you explain, Tim, what about you? Are you muted again?
I'm so sorry, you guys. Like right when you were getting bombarded by The Independent, I started getting bombarded by a lawnmower outside my door. I jump up, slam the door, but I muted it so you wouldn't hear the door slam. Now I'm back.
You have so many domestic adventures when we're recording. Like there's like people coming in your backyard, and there's fires, and there's basement.
Oh, that's true.
It's like a video game over there.
Yeah, this one's kind of pedestrian. It's just a guy mowing his lawn, but he just sounds like he's right outside my door. I think that Bendrix is swayed in part by evidence, but I think it's key. It's absolutely crucial that the evidence is not the sort that would be supplied by Smythe. Because what Smythe is providing is a very sort of this-worldly, apologetics sort of defense for his atheism. And I think if Smythe was playing the other side, he's arguing in kind of a rationalistic manner for, you know, the early dating of the Gospels, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that Morris would be converted by that. But I do think that there are other evidences, these glimmers of miracles that seemed to be cropping up in this story. I think those count to him as evidence. I think he is having a hard time looking away from those.
I think I changed my answer.
Disregarding those.
I think you changed my mind with what you just said. Yes, that.
So, okay, then how were you?
It's not like the evidence, like Smythe, right? Hiding?
Right. Like apologetics. Like
he looks with disdain. Yeah. He looks like with disdain. The book seems to look with disdain on that form of argumentation.
Okay, so Heidi, you were...
Sorry, David.
No. You were very definitively against the concept, and now your mind has changed, but how were you reading it? And then my question for that is, if not evidence, then what was he?
Yeah, always be careful and don't just start saying things on the air. Just start talking.
Yeah, you might get called out on it.
Thinking through things. This is a good lesson for me.
No. Keep doing that at the podcast. We need people to talk.
Thankfully, nothing much is at stake here because you just changed my mind. And now it changed my mind. So I think the idea of a pile of evidence, a blueprint, a weight of evidence, those are the words that the reviewer used, sounded to me a little bit clinical and intellectualized, as though he looked at one, the pros side and the con side and decided to believe. And that's absolutely not what happened to either him or to Sarah. And so in that sense, I offhandedly rejected the entire meaning of the word evidence. And I no longer stand by that, because exactly what you said, Tim, it was in part by evidence and in part by experience. He had a very existential kind of, I don't know what you'd call this, like a pre-conversion, like the pre-game.
They call that a crisis.
Yes. And it was very existential and rooted in emotion and relationship. But also there are these miracles, and he can't get away from that. And they are facts in his mind that might have a different interpretation, right? But they pile up to become evidence. The word blueprint in that review, the idea of if you sit in the back of a church and look at a crucifix, that's some kind of blueprint. I don't see that in the novel at all. I think the novel is examining exactly what you just said, David, which is crisis. Those moments in our lives, and we all have them, when something happens that shakes us and you have to pick a lane. And there's you can't not pick a lane somehow in your inner world, in your inner life. And that the lane you pick sometimes has something to do with evidence, but not it is a very existential experience. And I see that in the novel.
Absolutely.
I think it's interesting because I think that it's interesting the way he phrases it, because to me, he says the weight of evidence becomes too much, and it's not the evidence itself. It's the weight. It's the word weight that is the transformative concept there, because for Bendrix, it's like a sort of gravity, right? Like it pulls and pulls and pulls and pulls and pulls, and he's resisting and he's resisting and he's resisting. And rather than resisting in a way that gives him more strength, in a way that kind of like working out where you're building up muscles, he's resisting, he's resisting and resisting until he breaks down. Until the weight is too much. The weight is not making him stronger. The weight is revealing his own weaknesses. And so I think that where the evidence comes in is, he is not prepared to change his mind, and his heart certainly is not changed. I mean, I think there's some semantic business in what I just said there that could be unraveled, but is not changed until he begins to put two and two together, if you will. I don't want to be too clinical, because I know that simple arithmetic is very clinical. Once he begins to put two and two together as far as the miracles, that's when he begins to put his own guard down, and you know, he begins to stop fighting. And I think that is really a crucial part of the book. And I think it's fair to call that evidence because, yeah, I think that is fair to call it evidence because I think that what's happening is what he's seeing is the work of God at the proof of God being at work in the world. In a way, he's seeing a sort of incarnational faith at work. Yes. And I think that that's what the evidence is. He's seeing evidence, not of like, syllogisms, but he's seeing evidence of an incarnation of God's incarnation in the world. You know, in a sense, I don't mean to say like, you know, we're not talking like Parker's Back where there's, you know, literally some kind of incarnation of Christ himself, but there is a sort of incarnation of God's work in the world. Sorry, Slack is talking to me. And Slack just distracted me. So anyway, I'll end my thought right there. Someone else talk now.
I think that word evidence is like the word proof. It's become so loaded with meanings that we've kind of derived from the scientific method, and we forgot. We often, unless you're kind of like in the classical world, and you think about rhetorical proofs as just like strong arguments with like a clear conclusion. You know, that's what I think of now when I think of proof. But I used to kind of like, I had like a much more mechanical view of what a proof was. A proof was something that when you got to it, it could not be disputed and still consider yourself a rational agent. You know, you couldn't be a logical person and deny a proof. But I think, so same thing with evidence. Evidence is, we typically, or at least I should just speak for myself, typically think of evidence as sort of what a forensic scientist does in a lab. You get to the conclusion of, you know, amassing facts and data and materials, and that's your evidence. You've arrived at these evidences that you can almost reach out and touch or look at with a microscope. But the sorts of evidences I think that Bendrix is compelled by, and even Sarah is compelled by, are they're supernatural things that cannot be explained. They can't be explained. You can't reach out and touch them, and they seem to just exist. Like, she prays that Bendrix not die, and maybe he was dead or maybe he was not dead, but he rises, and she can't explain that. And she takes it as something supernatural, and it's an evidence of something supernatural. And I think that he sees these miracles laid in the book the same way.
Well, I think
evidences that, of something that can't be explained that are supernatural. Sorry, David.
No. I thought you were done. Sorry. I think that the book absolutely creates these if then scenarios all throughout, and the characters themselves at least are you know, thinking in that fashion. You just mentioned the moment when she sees him lying there under the door after the mm-hmm. bombing, and she prays, and you know, she says, she basically essentially says, if you let him live, then I will, you know, leave him, you know, or whatever. And then that kind of way of thinking motivates so much action in this book, and so much movement towards faith. Towards the very end of the book, one of the last few pages, Bendrix has this bit here, and it sounds to me, I'd love to hear what you guys think of this. It sounds to me almost clinical, like almost like a logic professor or something, very philosophical at least. He says, I have no peace and I have no love except for you, you. I said to her, I'm a man of hate, but I didn't feel much hatred. I had called other people hysterical, but my own words were overcharged. I could detect their insincerity. What I chiefly felt was less hate than fear. And then this bit here. For if this God exists, I thought, and if even you, with your lusts and your adulteries and the timid lies you used to tell, can change like this, we could all be saints by leaping as you leapt, by shutting the eyes and leaping once and for all. If you are a saint, it's not so difficult to be a saint. It's something he can demand of any of us. Leap. but I won't leap. I sat on my bed and said to God, you've taken her, but you haven't got me yet. I know you're cunning. It's you who take us up to a high place and offer us the whole universe. He goes on there. We can talk about that passage if you want. But this whole, you know, he's even talking here in sort of if-then scenarios, or if this happens, then that happens. And it's like all these characters are sort of making deals with God, and they're, you know, their pathway to faith, but more important, well, not more importantly, but their pathway on the way to faith of being broken down is definitely related to the evidences of God's work, you know, in the world. And like the way he talks about it sounds like, you know, my college logic professor, sounds like something you'd get out of a, you know, a book on syllogisms or something. Maybe not syllogisms,
but yeah.
Like there's a logical equation here, and that's what he's working through. You know, if it's possible for you to be a saint, then it happened. This has to be real, you know? And so for him, it's all about, right. You know, if this is true, then okay, this is true. And the big difference there to me, this is a big change for him. This is one of the things that I think is really interesting about the end of the book. That's not necessarily how he had been thinking. He had been ruled by his passions, not his logic. And so in the end of the book, he almost is ruled by the, if we're taking the duty and passions concept that Heidi has talked about so eloquently, then what we have here is him basically saying, if this is true, then this is true. And because this is true, my duty is to do this. So he has been ruled by his passions throughout, but now we're getting a merging of the passions and duty together, because he recognizes that there is a reality in the universe that he hadn't recognized before, and thus was permitted to rule, let his passions rule him.
Right. I completely agree. I think I was taking notes on this exact thing, and you used the word crisis earlier, David, and I was thinking the only way for the love of God to break through to his heart is through a crisis of desire. And so he took away the object of his desire, and now Morris has to live without that. And he even says that at the end of that paragraph that you read, that you're a devil, tempting us to leap, but I don't want your peace and I don't want your love. I wanted something very simple and very easy. I wanted Sarah for a lifetime, and you took her away. I hate you, God. I hate you as though you existed. And I think that crisis of desire is the only chance that somebody this lost has to find the path of salvation, or be found by God and shown the path of salvation. And I think for Sarah, who, as I've been wondering throughout this book, I wonder if she's more, you know, a desire-driven or a duty-driven. I think she is more of a duty-driven person, because it's her crisis of duty that, like, her path of salvation has to go back to the sacrament of marriage. That's very clear. The trajectory of her salvation has to go through Henry. And then poor Henry at the end. What do you all make of him? Where's he at the end of this novel?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the duty thing, because in a sense, what he, you know, when it comes to the sacrament of, you know, well, you mentioned the sacrament of marriage, but like when it comes to like, when, how they're going to bury her or cremate her and all that, and you're talking all these different things. Henry's, I mean, not Henry, Bendrix is, he's being driven by his passions, right? He's being driven by his own resistance. And Henry is like, but what's the right thing to do? And he, you know, that's one of the things that I think suggests there might be hope for him, is that he is not completely bought into one of the other sides there. He's trying to figure out what the right thing is to do by her, if you will. He's in the point in the process where he's full of confusion and fear, and but he doesn't have the wellspring of hatred that Bendrix has, and so in some ways it suggests that perhaps he might also be on his way. But his desire to do the right thing and his wrestling with that, even in the face of Bendrix's persuasion, I think is compelling and hopeful. Tim, what do you think?
I thought his conclusion was very hopeful, but that's another one for me. It'd be hard for me to, it was more of an intuition. It'd be hard for me to really find a strong proof text for that.
Yeah, I agree. And Morris is continually the one who's blocking Henry, right? He is, every time Henry's like, but what if? What if we should give her a Catholic burial? What if, you know, he's trying to be, you know, the dinner with the priest is such a example of that. Henry's trying to engage the priest in conversation. Morris shuts him down. So perhaps with Morris on a pathway, you know, at the end of the novel, he believes. He doesn't yet love, but he believes.
And,
you know, the implication, especially to us Christians, is, well, that's enough. Like, that's the grace for the step you're on. And they will continue to walk deeper into grace.
Yeah. I think it's so interesting also that Bendrix recognizes that Smythe doth protest too loud. Like, his argument early in the book is so full of venom that even Bendrix can kind of recognize, oh gosh, he's, or maybe it's Sarah, he's afraid, and he's arguing, he's afraid that God might exist. It may really be possible. And that's part of the reason that his arguments have such venom and heat behind them, because, you know, he's terrified. God might actually be out there. And I find the conclusion of Bendrix's story, especially at the dinner with the priest, to be the same thing. He's arguing with such heat. He can't stand the sight of the priest. And to me, that's when I started thinking, oh gosh, maybe Bendrix is on the path. He's doing the same thing that Smythe is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Heidi, I have a question. I seem to recall David early in this series of podcasts saying, or maybe you said it, that you did not like the ending of the book. Is that true?
I was literally just going to ask this.
Oh.
I think the ending is great. I keep saying this, and people keep explaining it to me, and I keep being like, yeah, I agree with you. But I just don't buy them being best friends at the end of the novel. I just think it's I just think it doesn't work.
Yeah.
I think it doesn't work.
See that, but is that how you read it?
Yes. I can't do without you. Our evening walks are the best thing. Come and live it. That's not Henry.
Ooh, that's not how I read that at all.
Actively, like, it's like, come live in my house. I don't know. That is the only part of the novel that feels like a neat little bow tied onto there.
Yeah.
Look, I can even make my husband and my lover be BFFs forever.
Right.
I'm a saint.
David, you don't read it that
way? Yeah, but that's what she would do.
Yes, I know. That's why. So
that's what she would do if she could have had the choice, because they need it. They don't just want them to be lonely. But also, I think. Well, Tim, go respond to this.
I read their relationship as, you know, the Odd Couple. Remember that old 60s or 70s show, The Odd Couple? Mm-hmm. You know, they just can't, they don't like each other, but they end up being roommates and they kind of are forced to kind of get along.
What you're saying is this isn't Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yeah, these are not like ride or die bros. I think they're two guys that don't have anything left. What do these guys have left?
Yep. I think
Bendrix is so miserable. He is the saddest person in London. He is so sad. I'm like, if he developed a drug habit, he would be happier. He's so miserable.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't know that. Say, Dave, say.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that him standing by Henry is just further evidence of the duty. To me, them being there for each other, so to speak, to put it simplistically, is evidence of two things: despair and character evolution. If it had been that, in like, it's evidence of the fact that they have changed as people, that what they've been through has altered them. You know, and it's Bendrick saying, this guy needs me. And in a way, I think it's Henry recognizing Bendrick's loneliness as well. And that's why I think, I think that's why, I think Bendrick realizes he had no real reason to hate Henry. And I think that Henry realizes that he needs to forgive Bendrick. And I think that's sort of what's happened. And I don't think I don't think they're partners. I don't think they're like pals. I think that what they are is they're two very lonely people bordering on despair who are having existential crises and they're very sad. And they are both in a way doing the duty that they believe Sarah would want them to do, because she loved them each each of them in a different flawed way. So I don't read them as like best friends. Like, you know, if they're staying up watching The Simpsons at midnight, it's more because they're like, what else are we going to do?
What else am I going to do?
And he needs me to be here. Maybe it evolves. I mean, maybe they grow into, you know, maybe they're Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid sitting on the, you know, what's the British version of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid? Maybe it evolves into that, but go ahead, Tim.
I wanted to ask Heidi about this. I'm going to preface it with a slightly obscure literary reference. Have you guys seen the movie or read the play, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yes.
Do you know that play?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So just to recap it for people that haven't seen it, a husband and a wife invite this young couple over, and the husband and wife are just on the last legs of their marriage, and you know, a variety of different events happen during the evening, and they are at each other's throats. They're probably in their 50s, at each other's throats. It's such a difficult play. The whole night, they just keep, like, the stakes keep getting higher and higher and higher until finally the marriage just snaps. It's ostensibly over. Then the sunlight comes up, and this couple, like, they've just kind of clawed each other down to the bone. And now the other couple is gone, and they're in their house, and there's kind of nothing left to do but be there with each other. And there's this kind of hopeful moment at the end of the play that, like, okay, we got down to bone, and now we can actually build something together. My friend Dan loves the ending of this play. He's like, right, that's how, like, sometimes it has to get to that. And I just think, if you do that much damage to somebody else, I just don't see how you're going to build it back. I mean, it's possible. Of course, it's possible. But it just seems like the destructiveness, the hurt that they've done to each other makes any sort of future, for me, difficult. It's not really terribly plausible to me. And I wonder, Heidi, if that's how you view Sarah's husband. What's wrong with me?
Henry. Yep.
Do you, if they've done so much,
it's a British novel. The husband is probably named Henry.
Yep. Yeah, right. Or Edward.
Yeah. Right. Odds are that they can't, like, they couldn't be best friends.
Yeah. I just don't think. I think that what you're getting at is important, that there is
I don't even know, 5 billion people in the world at the time that this novel was written. Like, I can see structurally in the novel why it's important that they maintain a relationship, because it's a novel, and the novel has its own world and its own rules. And within the world of the novel, for what each of them represents, they need to have some kind of connected relationship at the end for there to be resolution, right? I don't know that, like, sustained living together conditions between a cuckolded husband and the man that she was sleeping with and in love with has to be there. Like, I think you could achieve that by them, like, seeing each other at a bar and nodding to each other from down the bar.
Like that, the level of relationship at the end seems psychologically unrealistic to me, even for a passive man.
Heidi, I think you're right.
Even for a passive man like Henry is, because he's not passive. Morris doesn't show up. Henry pursues him. Come live in my house. He like changes his study so that he has a place to live. Like he makes him a flat in the house. He wants to have a relationship with Morris. So I find it psychologically inconsistent. That doesn't mean I don't love the novel as a novel. It just means I get to the end and I'm like, really? Like, if I was sleeping with somebody, Scott would not want to, like, hang out with that guy, even if I died and performed miracles to save him.
So, so good. Man, Heidi, I think
that's such a
right.
hypothetical situation. I don't know that I would.
I actually asked Scott about that. I'm like, would you hang out with the guy that I was sleeping with for years? Like, and he's like, are you kidding?
Okay, did you then kind of like salt and pepper it by saying, okay, but what if I had performed some miracles?
Yeah, I mean, I did. I told him this story. Like, and so granted, Scott's not a passive person, but even, I don't know if that completely covers the psychological inconsistencies here. So that being said, I love this novel. I love this novel. As I get to the end of it, I have to suspend some disbelief in that relationship. And I think it's so primary to the novel that that's a flaw.
Mm-hmm. Heidi, I think that's a totally legit criticism. I think that's a good criticism. Because when Bendix moves in, I was like, wait, seriously? Wait, you're moving in to like save some money?
Yeah, but so was Bendix.
So did you look Bendix so what? Like so contemplative? Like you're thinking hard about this. So prove me wrong. Convince me.
I just think I think that's the point. Like okay. I think that's the point that it's psychologically inconsistent, and that's like. That's why I think that it's got to do with change. I mean, Bendix himself is like surprised that Henry would respond the way.
Oh, like that you're he did. Saying maybe it's part of Henry's like journey to salvation, like one of those miraculous occurrences that we're supposed to be like, whoa.
Yeah. And Henry
that could
also
only be supernatural.
Right. And Henry also recognizes his own, like, you know, it's not like he was doing everything he could for Sarah and then she was unfaithful to him. He feels deep guilt about it. And he knows that Bendix in a sense brought her some happiness. And so he's trying to do what he thinks she would want. He knows that she loved Bendix and cared about him in a way that she did not care for him because he was not able to be there, that he chose not to be there for her. And so he is trying to do his duty based on what she would want. I think that actually is psychologically consistent with him, but with who he was from the whole, throughout the whole book. But I also think that his ability to move on from his own, you know, hatred and the degree to which he, you know, responds to Bendix is driven by his own guilt and his own, you know, his own, his own path of salvation, I think. And, you know, if it was like, if the book wasn't surprised by it too, I would agree. But the book itself thinks that Henry's a weirdo.
Okay. So I don't know if I'm completely convinced, but that is the best argument I've ever heard.
the book thinks that Henry's a weirdo.
Yes, people have argued with you about this, Heidi.
Yes, I can't get over, never been able to get over it. And the reason it bothers me is because I love this novel so much. I love this novel. And so the fact that I kind of find that to be lame is and unbelievable bothers me. I want to reconcile that. So I think that what David said is the best argument I've ever heard. That's
argument about anything? Argument about anything?
I mean, no, not about anything. Just about that issue. It's a narrow focus.
Well, it's not really much of a compliment then.
You made a totalizing Is that a totalizing claim?
I mean, I have other problems in life that I'm happy for you to convince me and make a good argument. And then maybe I'll say a collection of arguments is the best. But
yeah, well, yeah.
Is there any way that Henry could be on the path to salvation, recognize his own culpability in Sarah's affair, recognize that, you know, his life has become prosaic and so duty bound that there's kind of nothing else to it? Can he both be that guy who is on the path of salvation, recognizing what needs to happen, and also think, man, I still want to cut that guy?
Yes.
Well, I kind of think so too.
Some of the saddest moments of the book are moments when, you know, Henry is expressing his sense of loss. You know, he has that line, something like, the next best thing to talking to her is talking about her. And he recognizes that, you know, there is such a deep loneliness and sadness in that, that is driving, I think, some of his actions too. And I think that Bendrix recognizes that, and there's some kinship in that loneliness. And I think that's a sort of kinship that goes beyond the, you know, that draws out a sort of psychological, it draws us beyond the scope of psychological normalcy. Like a loneliness that profound, that deep, and a sadness that profound and that deep causes us to act in ways that, you know, are not so by the book. And I think I think that that's what I'm saying is when I said the book recognizes that he's weird. And like, I think if any of us were reading it and we're like, yep, that's normal, then that would say that more that we're, right. I mean, I don't want to accuse anyone who thought that was weird of being like sad, but I think that that's sort of what would probably be the most likely conclusion. Like, I think the book itself thinks these are two broken, profoundly broken people. And, you know, the fact that in the end, they might be able to be on the path towards to their own individual paths of salvation together, I think is one of the things that makes the book hopeful in the end. And I think I think the book implies that, although Sarah, I don't think that the book suggests that Sarah was acting in that way. I think it implies that she wants them, you know, she has this, sort of prayerful attitude for both of them. I think that's why she goes back. She promises that Henry shall stay with them.
I really like that.
Well, we're running out of time. Mainly I'm running out of time. Do we want to, what else do we need to talk about? We've got the Q&A next week. Anything else? Do you feel like we need to address on this particular episode?
I want to say just one thing. There's this pattern among some of these great Catholic 20th century novelists. I include Graham Greene. I include Flannery O'Connor. I include Walker Percy, who we're going to read this year. So many of them write stories that have this, that end not with an uplift, not with like a moment of salvation and clarity and freedom, but they end at a kind of muted moment of decision. So I think about something like, there's probably a better example from Flannery O'Connor, but maybe Revelation. We get to the end of that book and there's not a conversion, but there's this sort of like vision of the alternative sort of life that one could lead. Now, is our character going to choose it? And almost all of Walker Percy's books, almost every novel ends with a decision moment where the main character is facing two antithetical choices, one toward God and one toward sort of like kind of an earthly hedonism. And we don't see a choice. We just know what the avenues are after the choice. And I just think that I find the conclusion of this book to be so similar, that we have this repeating cycle and Morris is either going to choose to kind of follow in the path of Sarah, or he's going to keep repeating the same pattern that we've been seeing over and over since the beginning of the book.
I think actually that more likely it's both, because I think that the, even Sarah's own story is this repeating cycle of doubt and faith going back and forth, and you know, through the whole of the novel, you know, after, from the time that she says the prayer to the time that she dies, she's weaving in and out of that. We see it in her letters. And so I think that that's one of the reasons why he does that, because I think that it's about making the decision over and over again. You know, it's about touching Henry's arm over and over again. I think that's, it's not just about the one moment that's going to lead you forward. It's about the fact that, you know, the path of salvation is, in this scheme, if you will, is twisting. And sometimes you double back, not, you know, and then God draws you back to him. And I think that that's why I think the notion of the cyclical nature of things is crucial in this. We can talk about the beginning of the book next week on the Q&A. So someone ask a question about that. Did you want to say something about this, Heidi?
Okay. Yeah.
No, I just really love that. And I think that that's the great Catholic novel of the 20th century is, in my opinion, this is just an opinion, but I state it strongly because I believe it strongly. It is the redemption of the modern novel, because the modern novel is, and I'm using modern in a very specific sense, like in a literary sense, is a novel of that explores hopelessness and despair and the loss of belief and the loss of hope. And you can't just come charging in with a neat little bow at the end of your novels anymore. Like, that ship sailed in the 20th century. And then the Catholic novelists came along, and I think they redeemed it. I love their novels because they did that. They said a life of faith is just as complex, just as much wrestling in the deep places of the soul. It isn't a neat little bow. Nobody is saying that. We know that. And here's the story of a complex, nuanced life that does fall under submission to faith, but it's hard fought. It's reluctant. And that is, in many ways, the modern man. And I'd say probably the three of us know that, right? Like, our faith is not a neat little bow. And neither is our listeners. And so those Catholic novelists got that. Maybe yours is. Mine is not. So I know it's not. But
that, yeah, I shouldn't have said that out loud.
I know. I love that about the Catholic novelists. I think they did something great, not just for literary history, but for salvation's history. Like, I think that what they did was profoundly important spiritually as well as literarily.
Everyone should check out, I believe you say his name, Rapatrazone, Nick Rapatrazone's new book, Longing for an Absent God, which is about the Catholic novels. You know, it strikes me that books like this, in many ways, Tim, you mentioned Flannery O'Connor, and she had the famous notion or phrasing or whatever that you have to shout for those that are hard of hearing. And in many ways, it feels like these Catholic novels often are about people who are either willfully or for other reasons, hard of hearing. Maybe the malaise has set in, or maybe they've made choices. And so, you know, their ears have been covered, or, you know, they're like earwax or something, you know, so to speak. Just go with me. But that the books in the books themselves, a shouting has to happen. And, it, you know, when you read a book like this, although it doesn't seem like shouting as it's happening per se, there are these moments where it seems like, you know, a shouting is happening. You know, it's Sarah's being shouted at when Bendrix is lying under the door, and then ultimately Sarah dies, and there's a sort of shouting in that, and there's all these miracles, and it's like God is sort of, you know, it's the done thing, right? This is a book so much about pursuit, and that's why there's so much, like, you know, almost erotic language in it, because the fundamental to it is the pursuit of God. It's like what Dunn is doing in his work. We talked about this earlier. And it's a sort of shouting, you know, it's a sort of shouting where God is saying, I want you. And they're not listening. They're not hearing the idea that they are desirable. And so the book, you know, constantly throughout these books, it's people like, you know, Bendrix in this book, or, you know, O'Connor Charles characters Ryder. Or Charles Ryder, or, you know, in the movie goer, it sounds like Bendrix. What's his name in that one?
I never read that.
Well, I forget what his name is. But you know, they're being pursued by God, and they're being shouted at, and that's what, you know, it's that pursuit is salvific, I guess. But okay, well, I need to wrap this up. Thanks so much, guys. Do you have any final thoughts?
No,
I'm good.
All right, well, for Heidi White and for Tim McIntosh, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening, and until next time, happy reading.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.